بقلبها ديابة تزليل بالناس هم واللي نام في الغابة راح يتاكل هم يا بقلبها ديابة ديابة نازلين في الناس هم واللي نام في الغابة الغابة راح يتاكل هم واللي يضير وشه في غمضة عين يتهم ده اللي يضير وشه حالا غمضة عين يتهم
Welcome to Midris Panorama on Resonance FM. I'm Nadim Mahjoub.
On November 7th, 2001, less than 2 months after the 9/11 attacks, former President Bill Clinton addressed our new state of affairs with a high-profile speech at Georgetown University. In addressing the root causes of the conflict, he said the following, quote, "Those of us who came from various European lineages are not blameless. Indeed, in the First Crusade, when the Christian soldiers took Jerusalem, they first burned a synagogue with 300 Jews in it, and proceeded to kill every woman and child who was Muslim on the Temple Mount. The contemporaneous descriptions of the event describe soldiers walking on the Temple Mound, a holy place to Christians, with blood running up to their knees. I can tell you that story is still being told today in the Middle East, and we are still paying for it." Unquote.
A leading review of the Crusades on Amazon.com says the following. The Christian invaders were regarded as infidels. The Arabs were scorned as lawless pagans. The Westerners saw their quest as literally a sanctified crusade, while the Muslims launched their own holy war called Jihad in retaliation. Sound familiar? It should, because although the events depicted in the History Channel's documentary The Crusades, Crescent and the Cross took place nearly 1,000 years ago, they are but a distant mirror to what's going on in the Middle East right now. Unquote.
This was the collision of two great faiths. The clash between the Crescent and the Cross.
Were the Crusades religious wars? Many Muslims believe that the Crusades continue today and see the so-called War on Terror as a crusade against Islam. The three Crusades started in the late 11th century, when Pope Urban II dispatched a huge force to reclaim Jerusalem, which had been under Muslim control for some 400 years. For the knights and others who made the journey, it was a noble spiritual quest, not to mention an escape from Europe's petty wars and famines. In the end, the fact that many of them were greedy butchers who murdered Muslims, Jews, and even other Christians indiscriminately, sometimes even eating the flesh of the vanquished, detracted not at all from their conviction that they were acting in the name of God. Of course, so were the Muslims, who after the bloody First Crusade succeeded in seizing the Holy City, mounted a massive counterattack under leaders like Nur ad-Din and his son Saladin, who managed to take back Jerusalem and hold on to it through the failed Second and Third Crusades, the latter led by England's Richard the Lionheart. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith of Cambridge University is probably Britain's leading historian of the Crusades. The Crusades, he writes, helped shape many notions still current in today's world, ranging from concepts of religious violence through anti-Semitism to ethnic cleansing. Interpretation of the Crusades has also changed to reflect the mood of the times. Once considered as religiously motivated, the Crusades later metamorphosed into an early manifestation of European imperialism. Then they became a monstrous enterprise motivated by greed. Has the pendulum now swung back again to favor religious interpretation?
Yes, there has definitely been a reconsideration of the motivations for the Crusades over the last decades.
Professor Konrad Hischler of the School of Oriental and African Studies.
While in the 20th century, on the basis of the then dominant materialistic social science approaches, the focus has been on the material gains which could be won by participating in a crusade. In the recent years, one has started to take again the motivation of the participants in the crusades themselves more seriously. This also based on the reason, if you consider the material gains the participants could have won by participating in the Crusades were entirely irrational endeavors. The risk of being killed due to warfare, due to starvation, due to diseases was extremely high. But even those who did not die, those who were not killed, did gain very little. If we consider those who participated and returned to Europe, most of them had spent more on financing their participation in the Crusades than they ever won during their stay in the Middle East. So the materialistic argumentation or the materialistic analysis of the Crusade has not given us very convincing arguments in order to explain the rise and the continuation of the Crusades.
This is not a view that everybody agrees with. John Helen of the Street Evangelists Association, for example, sees the Crusades as political wars aimed at creating an empire.
My view is that they were historic and they had a reason, but mainly that they were, and they were not religious in the sense that everyone else thinks they were. And being a political power, Britain, they sought to have an empire throughout the world. And because of that, they actually did make an empire eventually. But it began in the Crusades. And the point is, it was misunderstood, and many people thought differently. They thought it was a religious thing because they put a cross on it. But they were also commissioned by the church to go abroad and take new places and conquer other places throughout the world. But I don't necessarily think it was a spiritual act. It was a political, you know, belief that they had to conquer the world and have an empire.
It is also argued that the social conditions of people in Europe at the time played a major role in making them believe in a better life on Earth, as well as in the afterlife.
There was good reason why men would risk everything to journey to a distant land from which they might never return. Blighted by famine and racked by petty wars, their European homeland was a cursed place. They craved a better life in this world and the next.
The History Channel documentary, The Crusades, Crescent and the Cross. Those who favor the materialist interpretation speak about the Crusades as a movement driven by religious fanaticism, but had a definite economic basis, one of which was the situation in Europe at the time. Yunus Bakhsh, writer and union activist in Britain.
The reality is, of course, the real causes of the Crusade and the backdrop to it was a crisis of feudalism, and it had strictly materialist roots. Europe was a backwater, part of the world which was largely described even by the likes of Pope Urban II, who actually called for the Crusade, as a barbarous land. It was an area of the world which was synonymous with backwardness, with underdevelopment, and so on. It was an area in which, you know, there were kingdoms, estates competing against each other, fighting constant battles, treaties being broken, and so on. It was an area of the world where there was very little cultural development. It was a cultural backwater. It was an area of the world in which there was, again, because of the feudal class structure, which was acting very much as a fetter on the further developments of society, it was an area which suffered from regular famines, from plagues and pestilence, which were linked to the low development or low level of development of society. And what you had was a situation whereby, because the way in which land was handed down, because it went to the eldest son, it meant there were significant numbers of what you would call knights, you know, the sons and daughters, or the sons predominantly, obviously, of the landed estates, who had very little to do other than practice jousting and chivalry and so on and so forth, in the hope that one day they'll acquire the skills to go out and be robber bandits like their parents. So that was Europe. In the years prior to the launch of the First Crusade in 1065, there was an attempt in Europe by the popes to introduce a degree of centralisation, of a theocratic structure on Europe under their control, which they saw as a means of taking Europe forward. Because even the ruling class recognised that there were real problems with the constant infighting, the battling, the factions that took up so much of people's time and energy, and so much of the wealth of society was devoted to warfare, internal warfare, intestine warfare, which actually meant that society was basically unable to take things forward. Urban II, who was the Pope who called for the First Crusades, had attended the Council of Piacenza, where effectively he discovered that the Byzantine Empire was effectively crumbling, that the Islamic world was incredibly weak and divided, and really he saw there an opportunity to move his power base and the influence of his particular section of the ruling class to the east. He saw it as an opportunity to increase the wealth and power of the church and of the Pope, and also as a means of relieving pressure on Europe. Because you see, at that time there was immense pressure from below, because the peasantry, who were providing effectively the means and the wealth for the people at the top of society, could simply not go on. At that time, and for example, there was a massive famine in 1063. The church organised demonstrations, penitential demonstrations, where basically they said, the reason we're all starving is because it's God's will, and the only way we can stop starving is to basically say we're sorry to God. And people went off in their thousands to Jerusalem to try to reach the point whereby they could come closest to God to say they were sorry. They were sorry that they were starving, and so on. That was the backdrop to the beginnings of the Crusade. Economic crisis, a political crisis, and a need really by sections of the ruling classes in Europe to actually break out of that.
Yunus Bakhsh, writer and union activist in Britain. In his monumental work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the celebrated English historian Edward Gibbon writes, "In the pillage of public and private wealth, the adventurers had agreed to respect the exclusive property of the first occupant and the spoils of the great mosque. 70 lamps and massy vases of gold and silver rewarded the diligence and displayed the generosity of Tancred. Bloody sacrifices was offered by his mistaken votaries of the God of the Christians. Resistance might provoke, but neither age nor sex could mollify their implacable rage. They indulged themselves 3 days in a promiscuous massacre, and the infection of the dead bodies produced an epidemical disease. After 70,000 Muslims had been put to the sword and the harmless Jews burnt in their synagogue, they could still reserve a multitude of captives whom interest or lassitude persuaded them to spare." Unquote. The denigrators of the Crusades stress their brutality and savagery, which cannot be denied, but they offer no explanation other than stupidity, barbarism, and intolerance of the Crusaders.
Well, the savagery is not so obvious as it might seem at first glance if we look at the famous massacre of Jerusalem once the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem in 1099. You have this famous massacre where supposedly tens of thousands of local inhabitants were killed.
Professor Konrad Hischler of the School of Oriental and African Studies.
Colleagues from working on the Western sources, on which I myself am not working, have questioned recently the description which these sources give of the massacres, and have argued that these descriptions of massacres are very often styled upon passages in the Bible from the Apocalypse. So that the description of the massacres were aimed at a European audience in order to show them the momentous events taking place in Jerusalem and not necessarily what really was taking place in the streets. If we look at the Arabic sources on which I'm working, on which I'm more familiar, again, the evidence for a massacre in Jerusalem is not really so convincing. The best description which we have dates from a source some 130 years later, and that's the first time the famous number of 70,000 victims appears. So it took 130 years before the first Arab writer put the number of 70,000 into paper. And I'm very reluctant to believe that there was such a large-scale massacre as it is portrayed in later sources. Even if we accept that there was a large degree of barbarism and savagery during this period, this was not specific to the Crusades. Every warfare which was aimed at the non-unbeliever, be it warfare conducted by the Muslims or be it warfare conducted by Christian, warfare aimed at the unbeliever was by definition a warfare which involved massacres and barbarism. So, in order to explain the savagery and the massacres which took place during the Crusades, we need not to explain them as being specific to the Crusades, but rather we need to see them in the context of the warfare at that period. If there was anything specific to the Crusades, then it was a high number of, let's call them, non-professional combatants, i.e. those who were not mercenaries, those who were not soldiers but who were civilians and who accompanied the Crusades and who tended to conduct warfare in a rather unconventional manner, to put it that way. But in general, I would see the Crusades very much in the framework of warfare at that period aimed at the unbeliever.
Many Franks, writes Desmond Seward in The Monks of War, had been sent on the Crusade as penance for atrocious offences such as rape and murder, and reverted to their unpleasant habits. Pilgrims were a natural prey, though one of the principal objects of the Crusade had been to make the holy places safe for them. Tariq Ali, author of The Blood of Saladin.
The Franks, which was the catch-all word for everyone who participated in the Crusades, were regarded for many centuries until this day as barbarians who came to destroy the peak of Islamic civilization. And this is a very strong thing which goes down right to this day. So the word crusade is electric and people know it. They know what happened in that world.
The purpose of the Crusades was supposed to be to defend Christendom from the Muslim threat. Specifically, the Western Church was supposed to come to the aid of the Byzantine Empire, which was being hard-pressed by the Seljuk Turks. But when the Crusades eventually came to Constantinople in the Fourth Crusade, it was as conquerors, not saviors. This was the formative period of capitalism in Italy, in which Venice, the great trading power of the Eastern Mediterranean, played a leading role. The Venetian merchant princes were in the process of displaying Byzantium as the major power in the East, taking advantage of the advance of the Turks and the constant internal strife that rent Constantinople and sapped its strength. When Pope Innocent III launched the Fourth Crusade in 1204, the Venetians saw their chance. On April the 12th, the Crusaders stormed Constantinople. For 3 days they plundered it, causing terrible devastation. Even priests joined in the orgy of looting, murder, and destruction that culminated in the desecration of Hagia Sophia, the greatest church in Christendom, where a drunken prostitute was seated on the throne of the Patriarch. Yunus Bakhsh, writer and trade unionist in Britain.
The Crusades were effectively over, save for one little charming episode which took place in 1204, which is when the Crusades decided, well, we've had a shot at the Islamic world, why don't we now sort Byzantium out? And in 1204, they sacked the city of Constantinople. I've got a quote here which tells you about it. They attacked the city. The Greeks fought back. It says this: for 3 days, the Venetians and Crusaders rushed through the city, raping, killing and pillaging with a horrible eagerness. Women and children lay dying in the streets and nuns were raped in their convents. The Venetians knew the value of the treasures that they carefully purloined to adorn their own cities, churches and palaces. But the Crusaders from Northern Europe simply went on the rampage. In the great Basilica of St. Sophia, drunken soldiers tore down the great silk hangings and trampled the sacred books and icons underfoot, and a prostitute sat on the Patriarch's throne singing bawdy songs. This was the response of these individuals. That was how the Crusades ended. What started as banditry ended as banditry in a sacking of an apparently Christian city.
No one could possibly condone a movement, writes Professor Jonathan Riley Smith of Cambridge University, that through its cocktail of idealism, indiscipline, alienation and stress managed to give birth to such grotesque manifestations of inhumanity. Yet one should not criticize crusaders for being what they were not. They were not imperialists or colonialists. They were not simply after land or booty. And they were not too stupid to know what they were doing. Their scale of values was different from today's. They were pursuing an ideal that, however alien it seemed to later generations of historians, was enthusiastically supported at the time by such heavyweights as Saint Bernard of Clairvaux and Saint Thomas Aquinas. Unquote. Yes, the Crusaders went to the Holy Land with the cross on their banner, but they soon got down to the serious business of filling their pockets, plundering cities, sizing lands, and profitable trade routes. Tariq Ali, author of The Blood of Saladin.
Nothing is ever motivated purely by religion or ideology. They knew perfectly well that there was a lot of wealth in that part of the world. It was the center of trade. All the trading caravans passed through this world. And so they wanted the money. It was as simple as that.
The motives of the Crusaders, including the orders, were not so pure as one might think. The heady wine of religious fanaticism was mixed with a reasonable quantity of economic self-interest. For example, the Templars became successful bankers, anticipating the great Italian banking houses of the later Middle Ages. But the majority of those who went to the Middle East, says Professor Konrad Hirschler, did not enjoy the spoils of war.
Obviously, there are sections within the crusading participants who profited from the crusades. But as I said, the majority of the participants did not profit from the crusades. They lost out. They returned home poorer than they had set out. And most of the crusaders did not stay in the Middle East. They did not want to stay in the Middle East. They had no interest in staying in the Middle East. They wanted to go home as quick as possible. And they did not bring home wealth, gold, or anything worth for the future career. They had lost out by using important years of the career staying in the Middle East, and they lost out by investing enormous financial means into going on the crusade, financing the passage to the Middle East, etc. So the fact that some sections of the crusader participants profited from the crusade is, in my view, not enough in order to explain the crusades as a whole as a materialistic phenomenon.
But the lure of unimaginable wealth and the chance to seize lands that were said to flow with milk and honey was just the beginning. News soon spread of an even greater incentive. Pope Urban took an unprecedented step. He offered to those who pledged their souls to the crusade a ticket directly to heaven.
To those of you who once fought against brother and relative, now rightfully fight against the barbarians. Know then that whoever sets out on this journey, not out of lust for worldly advantage, but only for salvation of his soul and liberation of the church, is remitted in entirety all penance for his sins.
The Pope's sermon pushed the boundaries of Christian teaching. In his holy war, a crusader now had the blessing of God to ignore the sixth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," as long as he was an infidel.
The History Channel's documentary, The Crusades, Crescent and the Cross. The places that were holy to the Christians were also holy to the Muslims, who had occupied them since 638. Unlike the Christians, who were utterly intolerant towards other religious beliefs, the Muslims generally tolerated the Christians and other faiths, as long as they paid their taxes and did not cause trouble. Professor Konrad Hirschler again.
In the Islamic lands, there was definitely a higher degree of tolerance, because there was a possibility for Jews and Christians to submit to Islamic rule and then to live all bind in discriminated position, but to live in this society. This position was not available on this level in Christian societies. Christian societies had much more problems to accept other religions. So in this sense, it is true that Islam was much more tolerant. But when it comes to the point where the Christians do not accept anymore the rule of the Muslims, i.e. if they entered into warfare, then they broke the treaty between the Muslims and the Christian. And at that point, it would be very difficult to argue for larger tolerance by the Muslims vis-a-vis the Crusaders.
When Osama bin Laden and his followers refer, as they often do, to Crusades and Crusaders, they are not using language loosely. They are expressing a historical vision, an article of faith that has helped to provide moral justification for the actions of both Arab nationalists and radical Islamists.
Yes. I mean, historically, obviously, the use of the term is somewhat loose, as the first victims of the Crusades were Jews. I have the feeling that Osama bin Laden takes rather an aggressive stance towards people of Jewish faith. So when he accuses the West of launching a crusade against Islam, he somehow forgets that the Crusades were also aimed at non-Muslims, most especially Jewish people. At the same time, one has to see that the remembrance of the Crusade is a very modern phenomenon in the Middle East. Until the late 19th century, there was no collective consciousness of the Crusades at all in the Middle East. In the major languages of the Middle East, be it Arabic, Persian, Ottoman Turkish, or modern day, Ottoman Turkish, you don't find a word for Crusade until the late 19th century. There was never a term coined for Crusade because nobody cared about it. There were minor incursions. What really counted were the Mongol invasions. The Mongol invasions were major events, and they changed the fate of the Middle East. The Crusades did not change the fate of the Middle East. The Crusaders were minor incursions. They conquered marginal lands on the coast of Syria and never conquered any city of economic or political importance. They conquered one town of religious importance, this is Jerusalem. But Jerusalem has no economic or political importance at all, in contrast to the Mongols, who conquered nearly all the metropoles of the Middle East. So the Crusades were not really an issue for Middle Easterners until the late 19th century. And even then, all the books which were published in Arabic in the late 19th century were translation of European books. There was still no indigenous tradition of writing the Crusades. And it is only in the 20th century that you see suddenly an explosion of interest in the Crusades. And suddenly the Crusades became an important event due to European colonialism, obviously. That was the reason, and imperialism in order to set it into an historical context. But the Crusades themselves were not seen as anything of importance and were definitely not seen as a European attempt at expansion or European act of aggression aimed at the Middle East until the late 19th century. I.e., throughout 700 years of Middle Eastern history, this idea did not exist. So Osama bin Laden is drawing on a quite recent idea, and because it is quite recent, it is quite flexible. Let's say the idea of the Crusade being important is quite recent, and that's because you can still form it in many ways, you can still reshape it, you can tell it in a new way, you can set it in a new context. And as you said, the Arab nationalists used it in order to argue against European colonialism. In the Arab left, the Crusades played quite an important role, and today in the Islamist interpretation of history, obviously the Crusades play an extremely high role, where they are set into this eternal clash of religions between Islam and Christianity.
Professor Konrad Hischler of the School of Oriental and African Studies. Today, the Islamic fundamentalists, as well as many Muslims, regard the so-called war on terror as a war on Islam. This is why Osama bin Laden appears to be so emotional about infidel penetration, which he believes defiles Islam, and particularly its holy places. This is a battle of Muslims against the global crusaders. God, who provided us with his support and kept us steadfast until the Soviet Union was defeated, is able to provide us once more with his support to defeat America on the same land and with the same people. In war of civilizations, our goal is for our nation to unite in the face of the Christian crusade. This is a recurring war. The original crusade brought Richard Lionheart from Britain, Louis from France, and Barbarossa from Germany. Today the crusading countries rushed as soon as Bush raised the cross. They accepted the rule of the cross. Unquote. In fact, even some secular intellectuals share the view that the US and its allies are at war with Islam. Did not George W. Bush call his war on terror a crusade?
But we need to be alert to the fact that that these evildoers still exist. We haven't seen this kind of barbarism in a long period of time. No one could have conceivably imagined suicide bombers burrowing into our society and then emerging all on the same day to fly their aircraft, fly U.S. aircraft, into buildings full of innocent people and show no remorse. And this is a new kind of evil. And we understand. And the American people are beginning to understand. Now, this crusade, this war on terrorism, is going to take a while.
That is certainly one of the most, one of the more impressive discursive failure of the U.S. administration, that none of his advisors felt what this term would imply to Middle Easterners. The problem is that in English, obviously, crusade has a very positive meaning. You can have a crusade on poverty. You can have a crusade against a certain illness. So crusade might be a very positive term. And George W. Bush probably did not think too much about the use of this term and employed it in, I think it was in the immediate aftermath of 11th September. But that was a drastic mistake and was certainly one of the factors which contributed to a rather negative perception of this war on terror by Middle Easterners, because a crusade is only a negative concept, a negative term in Middle Easterners' ears. And whenever one conducts foreign policy which is linked to the Middle East, you never use the term crusade. That's rule number one. And it's just depressing how low the level of understanding of Middle Eastern feelings in the US administration was at this point, and hopefully is not anymore.
Professor Konrad Hischler of the School of Oriental and African Studies. The creation of the State of Israel, established on the very ground occupied by the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem, has been portrayed as an act of vengeful malice. The Lebanese poet Mahmoud Darwish, referring to the invasion of Lebanon by the Israelis in 1982, though metaphorically, described the invaders as leftover crusaders and their siege of Beirut as revenge for all medieval history. Professor Hischler again.
Israel obviously was very easily attachable to the idea of the Crusades, just because of the geographical coincidence, because of the kibbutz, the settlements, because of the question of Jerusalem, and so on. But again, one has to stress, the first victims of the Crusades were Jews. They were not Muslims. What we see today is, I mean, the creation of the State of Israel is in a modern context and in the context of a world which is divided into nation states. And the 11th, 12th, 13th century where the Crusades are taking place are completely different contexts. And nobody thought about something like building up nation states or anything similar to modern state. So the let's say to call the foundation of a state of Israel is analytically very little helpful. I mean, for propagandistic reason might be fine and it's understandable because, as I said, there are many outward similarities, but for an analysis it's not very helpful to analyze the state of Israel in terms of the Crusades. One should rather see it in 20th century context and not in the 12th century context.
One of the outcomes of the so-called War on Terror is that a Shia government is now in power in the government in Iraq, and that Saudi Arabia is still a good friend of the Western elite. So the argument that there is a war on Islam, says Ramzi Khoury, strategic communications consultant, journalist and columnist, should be counterposed by geostrategic interests argument, including the control of the oil supplies of the region.
This war is all about oil. This war is all about furthering the interests of Israel, whether they may be security interests or geopolitical interests. This war is about expanding the American military presence in this region. To say or to suggest that the war on terror has become a war on Islam is to say that American foreign policy in the region has changed. There is absolutely no proof of such change. American foreign policy has always been steadily a policy of double standards when it came to Israel, a policy of I am the power and you are the underdog. This is American foreign policy. Nothing has changed. This is not a war against Islam. There are many problems with America. There is a huge problem with American foreign policy, Tim. And most importantly is how the neoconservatives are running this administration in Washington, D.C. And let us take a look at their doctrine. Their doctrine is not a doctrine of religion. They have absolutely nothing against Islamists. For the first time ever in history, these neoconservatives have put their hands with what is unheard of. The Islamist Shiites in Iraq. It's never happened before. This is a godless war.
Ramzi Khoury, strategic communications consultant, journalist and columnist on Doha Debate in 2005. On 104.4 and on www.resonancefm.com, this is Resonance FM Radio. I am Nadim Mahjoub and you are listening to Middle East Panorama.
أقدامه السلاسل ربطوا يديه في صخرة الموتى وقالوا أنت قاتل أخذوا طعامه والملابس والبيارق ورموه في زنزانة الموتى وقالوا أنت سارق طردوه من كل المرافق أخذوا حبيبته الصغيرة وقالوا أنت لاجئ
Camilla Gibran in An Insan, About a Human. Thank you. You've listened to a piece called Assyria to Seville by Nasir Shamma. Thank you. Les Ailes du Bourak by Anwar Ibrahim and his group, and from the album Le Pas du Chat Noir. And the following piece is In the Search of the Well by Rabih Abu Khalil. Middle East Panorama Show is produced by Nadine Mahjoub for Resonance FM Radio. Middle East Panorama address is middleeastpanorama.blogspot.com. That's middleeastpanorama.blogspot.com.